Hey there, welcome to this episode of Tennessee Farm to Family. Let our team of extension agents bring the farm to your family. We'll explore all things agriculture and talk about how it gets to your table, fridge, or pantry. Meet farmers, stomp out misinformation, and grab a sneak peek into agri-search and outreach efforts.
Thank you all for joining us today on our inaugural episode of Tennessee Farm to Family, where we as extension professionals trying to connect you to where your food comes from. Happy to be joined today by some fantastic extension professionals. We all work across West Tennessee. I'll introduce myself. I'm Tracy Sullivan. I've worked in agriculture for almost 30 years, if you include my time in, 4-H and FFA. Currently work, we have a row crop farm, raise beef cattle. I've just kind of been in it most of my life. So
I'm Brian White, agent here in West Tennessee, been around extension for about 25 years now. Still help on the family diversified farm and keep an iron hot at both ends most of the time.
I'm Garrett, also from Northwest Tennessee, and grew up on a small cattle, cow-calf and row crop operation, and do work extension here today.
Okay, so I'm Lane. I've been in extension for about 2 years, but ag as a whole for about the last 10 years, and a lot thanks to our nice colleague, Justin Hargrove here. Started in co-op and then went to college and decided I wanted to study more about agriculture, and ended up just kind of following the trail through. Did some production ag, some farm to table ag, and then here doing consumer ag. So it's pretty interesting.
And my name's Hargrove. I grew up on a third generation cattle operation. Still raise beef cattle today. Also serve as a county extension agent, as well as somewhat of a fisheries role along with that. Been in extension now for 10 years, been dealing with agriculture since I was just a small pygmy child, but I guess professionally for about 15 years or so now.
So I think we all share a common passion for agriculture. And if anything, coming out of the pandemic has kind of shifted our culture, and we all saw empty grocery store shelves for the first time in a really long time. So it was important to me, as the narrative is changing. I feel like we've always had to fight for our industry, but even more so now with people having access to instant information through their cell phones, just trying to connect people to where their food comes from. I know we're seeing probably in, especially West Tennessee, farmers markets are hot. People want to buy local. And so we're starting this podcast to kind of educate you, bring our expertise, what we know scientifically. We won't ag geek out on you too much, or try not to, but just so you can go to the grocery store with some confidence and feel good about where your food is coming from. With that, kind of the topic we were going to hit on today is our food prices. I was sharing with this group, just yesterday I came home with my pickup order and was not happy with the size of the mound of groceries for, a few hundred dollars. So our food dollar is, less and less. It's going less and less. And we want to kind of explain some of the reasons of that. We all talked about the farm share of the dollar. So out of every dollar spent on food, the percentage going back to the farm is less and less. I think that number is around 14 cents this year. I taught agriculture to students about 10 years ago, that number was 19 cents. So it's getting less and less.
Yeah, it's getting to be concerning. I think it's the new all-time low as far as farmer share of the overall food dollar. And so, and conversely with that, we can look at the USDA farm income forecast, and they're estimating that in 2023, overall farmer income is projected to be down by 16% over last year. So farmers are, we're really kind of getting the raw end of the deal here on a lot of this stuff. But I mean, it's just as much as it's affecting the farmer, it's also adversely affecting the consumer as well. And that's something that we hope to be able to address today.
Yeah, anytime you add more transportation or added value to a product, you see where every business out there, food processors, your grocery stores, you know, just trying to get help, and they've all raised their salaries. Well, they have to pass that on somewhere. And unfortunately, that's the consumer.
Yeah, as inflation goes up, everybody wants their salaries to go up. And that includes people working in the food industry, which makes the price of your food go up. And it's a vicious cycle, I think. But I do, in our part of the world, I've seen an increase of, you know, packaging plants and stuff, and, you know, processing plants and stuff. And I think that's a good way for the consumer to get back maybe a larger percentage of that share you're talking about to the farmer, if you can buy direct from them. I know Hargrove, y'all are, you know more about that than I do. You're involved in that. But it's, I think that's a good way to give more of that percentage to the farmer.
Right. I think that there's certainly some potential for that. And there's seems like there has been an increase in the interest among farmers and agricultural producers, especially since COVID, to try to develop a little bit more of a direct sales model, working directly with their consumers, whether that be selling, whether that be selling meats custom exempt, or whether that be selling something USDA through a store counter or at a farmer's market. And the same thing goes with some of our vegetable producers and everything. A lot of those guys have got on you know, roadside stands and stores there on their property to be able to sell direct. But the issue is, direct to consumer sales are fantastic. It's an excellent opportunity for farmers to capture a greater share of that food dollar, but it's not really something that's going to solve the problem overall. This is something that I'm afraid that we're just going to kind of have to, as consumers, kind of ride this one out until the economy kind of balances itself once again in the long term.
Yeah, I think some food prices, you know, you were able to track those one or two things, that when eggs went up to $7 a dozen, you know, or almost $7 a dozen, we were able to say, well, there was avian influenza that, you know, took out a large population of our laying hens. But eggs are probably as cheap now as they've been in 10 years, probably. So the market has a way of correcting itself. I'm for one thankful that I don't have chickens that I did, that I went out and bought, you know, in a way to save money, because I'm just not home enough to care for those chickens, but to each their own. And I think this does speak, you know, I'm supportive of all the buy local food movements, but realize that we don't feed the world that way. And the more we go to that, the less places and opportunities there are for the masses to buy food. So I think there's room at the table for everybody to buy local, to buy your big box stores, to buy from, you know, the farmer beside you, et cetera, your farmer's market. So,
well, you know, when you think about it, I think probably my generation is probably the first generation to really not grow very much of their food at home. Like a very, very small percentage of it gets grown at home. And the boomers, you know, my parents, a little bit less, but their parents probably was a significant increase of raising their own hogs, raising their own steers, having a 3-4 acre garden, canning, stuff like that. I know my grandparents did it, and I don't know very many of my friends who do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can do that yourself, but when you get out of that, you learn less, you know, less about food production. So then you know less about what the farmers are dealing with. And, you know, you got to fight that misinformation.
When you know less, you trust less. Yeah. Like your opinion can be formed by outside influences. And we're seeing that on a large scale. So we're just here in our little part of the world and spot on the map to try to help educate people about where their food comes from.
Instant information is not always the right information.
That's right. That's right.
I think what's happened in the last few years, especially with the increase in food prices, there's some bright spots in it, just as we've talked about. More folks have went to those farmers market and look at the calls that we get, you know, on freezer beef, you know, and the questions from consumers, you know, concerned about how those animals were raised were. Well, if it was your neighbor down the road, it makes it easy. And like you said, Tracy, I know that's not going to feed the masses, but people need to realize the United States has the safest food supply in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's well regulated, unfortunately,
yeah, times.
But, you know, a prime example, you know, you're talking about, you know, the generation now is not raised as much, but my FCS agent is getting a lot more calls, and she's putting on canning classes, mm-hmm, you know, and look back, you know, a year or so ago, we couldn't find mason jars or tops or lids or whatever. So even if you go to the farmer's market and buy a crate of tomatoes, you know, you put up your own tomato juice or your salsa or whatever, you know, and I think we've got a lot more people doing that. And it does connect them back to the folks that we work with on a daily basis.
Yeah, and on the home horticulture side of things, you see a lot more people, even if they don't have the space to grow their own crops in a garden bed or a backyard, they're bringing those things inside. They're having their raised beds inside in pots and things like that so they can provide for their family. And you realize once you start calculating what you need, it's not as much as you think because one plant can produce so much. So on the fruits and vegetable sides of things, it's a little more usable in your home and it's not as hard as we all think it is. We don't have to have green thumbs. We just plant a lot. That's what gives us that. But that's just on the plant side of things.
Yeah. And I think the reasons people get into it, raised beds, that's a passion or hobby of mine too. I've gotten into it. You're not going to save money doing that. No. I mean, our commercial production agriculture system is by far the cheapest way you'll buy some of those things. But the therapeutic, knowing where it comes from, very satisfactory to pick some green tomatoes, slice them, fry them up for your family. Like that's very satisfying. But I had a friend who started her raised bed inspired by some of my posts. And she put a picture of some beautiful green lettuce on Facebook. Says, this only cost me $1,000. By the time you buy the lumber, the soil, the amendments, you know, all that stuff.
And you're right. And I didn't realize this till I researched it. You know, the average produce in your grocery store travels 1,800 miles. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't grow tomatoes here, except maybe Lee. But in the wintertime, you know, those come from warmer climates, you know, most likely, or greenhouses, whatnot. Our gardens are not producing then, so it's got to come from somewhere.
Yeah, and I think that shows you what power the consumer has. They may or may not know it, but it's the consumer-driven food market that says, we want tomatoes year-round. We want them red. We want them ripe in our grocery stores year-round. So the market has met that need by saying, well, we'll put them on a boat. We'll ripen them here. We'll do this, do that to get them to you. I mean, I look at the exotic fruits we have available, mangoes, star fruits, things we're not going to grow in our backyard, but the consumer wants it. They demand it.
I figure out what to get it to
them. The production system figures it out. Yeah. Yeah.
But like a good example from our original topic today is, you know, food price increases, and this wasn't any kind of research, but any stretch of the means, but I kind of took it upon myself. My secretary and her husband had bought a whole beef, and so he was going after it, and I asked him just come back by the office. So I took each of those cuts. I took all the ribeyes and the T-bones and the chuck roast and all, and I weighed all those, you know, and then I asked them what they paid for it. And then I just jumped online with Kroger, Walmart, and just done a very straightforward comparison. And on a whole beef, they purchased from somebody they knew, they was confident in it, and they knew where it come from, and it was $700 less than what they would have went to the grocery store and bought it a piece at a time.
Oh, I'm surprised it's that little. I figured it might be more. I'm going to pick up my freezer beef, in a week or so.
The thing that's hard to put a dollar value on it is the quality that you're going to get from a local producer than based on, our chain grocery stores.
Right.
You're going to get a better quality product. And sometimes it's hard to put a dollar value on, that eating experience at the supper table.
That's right. Well, the freezer beef thing, I think, and, we've seen a trend going, maybe it started with the eggs, maybe it started with pandemic, but, everyone's like having backyard flocks. So that's something easy, pretty low cost to get into. Now we're seeing backyard pork. So people want to raise their own hogs. So growing up, I grew up, in a family that was kind of old school. They did things, my grandparents, the old ways of preserving food and that kind of thing. Like what's old is new again. Yeah. Canning classes, big gardens, providing your own meat through some form or fashion besides the grocery stores.
When you think about it, back in the day, whole communities would get together and have hog killing days. And everybody would help, get all that meat processed, and then they take it back to their home. So that'd be cool if that came back. I don't know if it will.
In some places, it never left.
Yeah, probably never left.
And some states have a person who does that, like as a, you know, community event.
Well, I'll just say we've got folks in West Tennessee that host an event where you can just come watch that process.
Yeah.
You know, so hopefully it won't be a lost art.
That's
some of my fondest memories whenever I was a kid was hog killing and getting everything salted down, smoking at the smokehouse. And there's a lot to be said for a little bit of self-sufficiency on procuring your own meat.
And back to
some of this as far as what's driving some of these increases in costs and everything at the grocery store. I know we talked a little bit about with our farmers, we're expecting them to have less income this year. We're expecting prices to continue going up. I was looking at it with beef, for instance. I raise beef cattle, so it's a particular interest to me. I know last year we had some severe droughts out west that burned up a lot of people's pasture, burned up a lot of hay ground, costed them quite a bit in feedstocks. And so a lot of these ranchers that were really boosting the national beef industry and the inventory as a whole had to sell off. As a result, they've sold off heifers for slaughter that they would have retained otherwise for replacements. And that's kind of driven our overall beef cattle industry inventory across the U.S., down where I think we're at the lowest level on beef cattle since the 1960s. Mm-hmm. We're down 4% from last year. And you mentioned earlier with laying birds, chickens and whatnot, prices went up, but then they kind of leveled back out. But with chickens, we can raise replacement birds pretty quickly.
Yes.
Very fast. With beef cattle, it takes a long time to be able to raise those replacement heifers, get them into the system, and then even that much longer for them to produce calves to go in and build things up. So I think that that's an issue that we're going to continue to see for a few years on beef prices, is that just supply and demand. Right now, we've got a very low supply and demand is still strong. So
right.
A good example, you know, Justin, is last year, Texas sold 1 million cows that they normally would have not sold.
Right.
Well, that doesn't include Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, that are big cow states also. But you take Texas right there. Well, those cows were sent to market last year. Well, those cows didn't have a calf this spring.
Right.
Those calves didn't, you know, go to market and go on feed and end up on our plate, you know, later this fall. So, like you said, it takes a minute for it to happen.
Yeah.
You know, a cow can only have one calf a year, you know, and a hog can have 2.5 litters and chickens can multiply,
almost twice as rapidly.
Yeah, almost, I guess. So, you know, and from the beef standpoint, it takes a minute for that to happen. And then once Texas get rain, which I think they are finally, you know, it takes a minute to rebuild that herd. And then you have a lot of our ranch owners and farmers that are not young men anymore. And they've got out of the business, and how much it's going to take to get back in, you know, so we may not rebuild that herd.
It's going to be a lot. It's going to be pretty expensive to get back in if they sold that herd out. You know, prices are up. They're there.
Yes.
So to get back in, it's going to be a pretty good capital investment. So some of them may not.
Which the good thing is, if you look at beef production, you know, we're producing more beef with less cattle than we ever have. So, I mean, you got to give a cowboy's credit for that, for doing that. But
and that's the same pretty much. And the guy that, the farmer versus foodie guy, he put a chart up there, you know, about production in general, a lot of improvements made through science, not the kind of Frankenstein science that people are scared about, but just through improvements in production, which we work with in agriculture every day, but we're producing so much more on the same acres or less acres. So it's all, I mean, what environment or what industry has not been affected by technology improvements, efficiency improvements? So agriculture is the same way. And that more beef off from fewer cows is the same way if we were to say corn or cotton or soybeans or whatever. And our industry is cyclical for all the reasons. It's weather, it's, you know, national inventory. We're in a global economy. Agriculture is not unique. They're also in a global economy. So what happens in Brazil affects, you know, production here and sometimes prices here.
Well, even when the river in Ukraine got bombed or whatever happened a couple of weeks ago, it set corn up. Almost limit in a day. Now it's back down again, but it's that volatile. It's more volatile now than it has been, but it's volatile.
And if you do the Google thing about why are food prices increasing, the war in Ukraine is probably in the top two or three, and it's consistently because they are such a huge wheat producer. Well, you all might live somewhere that doesn't grow wheat, but you buy bread, you buy pasta, you buy those things that wheat is in. So it's all connected.
Yeah. In addition to that, Ukraine and Russia, I believe, provides, or at least before this war broke out, they provided about 25% of all commercial fertilizers used throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So you take out 25% of the fertilizer that's available to grow crops and be able to grow forages with, that's a huge hit. That drives the rest of your fertilizer prices way up. That really, really puts a pinch on our farmers as far as their total input costs. Also puts a hit on them as far as overall efficiency, how much they can produce per acre. And that has been a massive, massive hit to our overall food system globally. Yeah. So thank you, Putin.
Well, you'll see, you know, farmers here that we work with make decisions where not as much fertilizer is required. So we're going to grow more beans and less corn. And, you know, that happens across the country too. That's these year-to-year decisions where they have some ability to grow various things. In certain parts of the country, they don't have that flexibility. So it is all interconnected. And if we tried to cover all that in one episode, we'd be here all day and we'd be deep in the weeds. So I think with that, we'll wrap it up and encourage you all to follow us on our Facebook and Instagram pages. We'll send out facts. You can get to know us a little better. We do have some additional hosts that will join us from time to time. So we'll keep it mixed up, but we're excited. I think it went well. Mm-hmm. Thank y'all for doing this. And you can shoot us an email or drop us a comment on social media. Our email is TN Farm, the number 2 family at utk.edu. So thanks for listening.